Now, as we come to verse 46 and this till the rest of the chapter, I find some interesting insights into some hindrances to true discipleship that now Jesus brings out to expose so that we can see a little more clearly. Looking here at these hindrances, we will see an improper view of ourselves can hinder us, an improper view of others can hinder us, and an improper view of the call of God on our life can hinder us. And we don't want anything to hinder us. We want to lay aside every weight that entangles us in this world so that we can be equipped and prepared for what God has for us in our lives. And whether we're a homemaker, or whether we're involved in New York, or whether we're involved in digging ditches somewhere, or whether we're involved in whatever career we have or whatever social standard we have, God has a place and a plan if we're open to whatever that is. Let's jump into verse 46 where we left off. He says, "A dispute arose among them as to which of them would be greatest. And Jesus, perceiving the thought of their heart, took a little child and set him by him. And he said to them, Whoever receives this little child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you all will be great." Now the first thing that I see here is the disciples, though Jesus told them, "Let these words sink down in your heart." And he was about to go to the ultimate self-sacrifice, to lift his life up as a ransom for us, as a payment for our sin. The disciples didn't understand. They're still thinking in terms of the kingdom coming and the glory and the power, and now they're discussing the pecking order in that kingdom. You know, who's the greatest? Who's going to fit where? It amazes me that these are the apostles doing this. These are the chosen men of God. And how many times do you find them arguing over who's the greatest? They're not arguing great theological themes like you'd suppose. They're arguing, who's the greatest? Can you imagine? And yet that is human nature. Now, here's the problem. Maybe it was because of envy, because Peter, James, and John went up the mountain with Jesus, and they were envious of their position. And maybe it was because of pride on their part that, you know, the demon could not be cast out of that young man. And so there was these discussions going back, and I can picture them arguing and stating their points. And, you know, I can hear Peter saying, "Now, wasn't it me who received the revelation that Jesus was the Messiah?" And someone else saying, "Yeah, but wasn't you who said to him for him to not go to Jerusalem, and he had to say, 'Get behind me, Satan'?" Oh, yeah, I forgot about that one. I can picture these guys, you know, going through this. They're arguing who would be the greatest. Jesus, the blaring contrast of his ministry and his life with where these guys are at, now comes to bear here as he tells them, "Whoever receives me receives this little child in my name." The very fact that children hung around Jesus should tell us a lot. Children don't hang around intimidating adults. But there's something unintimidating about Jesus. He was so down to earth, so approachable, that even children felt comfortable in his presence. Now that's always a good sign. When kids like to be around you, that's a good sign that you're not so dignified, that you're caught up with yourself and put on airs of importance, that children would be afraid to come near you. You know, I think it's important when we start thinking of the importance of children that realize that God has called us to be like these children. And even, you know, we've received accusations as Calvary because, you know, some have said, well, we don't really care about children because we don't want them to be distractions in the adult service, so we want to put them away somewhere. You know, far be it from that. My heart and my desire is that kids would love to come to learn about Jesus. And where better can they learn except on their level? I was, you know, I raised in a church in which I was made to sit quietly for that hour of service, and it was hard. You know, when you only understand every 20th word that comes from the pastor, and you're fidgeting and you're distracting others, and then they can't hear the word of God, and you hear the babies and the crying and the papers crinkling and all these other things. It's hard for adults to hear, but then kids don't get anything. As soon as I had the opportunity, I bolted out of church. I didn't like church. I think the importance, really, we see a high priority for children here at Calvary. We want them to be grown. And you know what's funny? Because even the kids are the ones that want to come to church. They're like dragging the parents. "Come on, let's go to church. We're not going to church. Come on, Dad. Get up." Kids want to learn. And we ought not to put any stumbling block. In fact, we're called to be like them. And you receive them and welcome them. Now, children are great because they don't think about themselves. You know, in the sense that they're not worried about their rank or their pecking order or their importance. They're unpretentious. They're not thinking about their high-sounding titles, you know, and their names. And this is something that we need to learn if we're going to serve the Lord. We need to forget about ourselves, where we fit in the scheme of things, to esteem others more important than ourselves. That's what the Lord tells us. To think of others. Instead of coming in here thinking the world revolves around you, is anybody noticing me? Is anybody want to talk to me? You talk to someone. You reach out. You serve. But that's the problem so often with our life. It's been said, he who knows himself best esteems himself least. Like Paul said, I was the chief of sinners, he said of himself. Even though he was highly educated and in line to become a great leader in Israel, when he came to the Lord, he realized how full of himself he was. And he considered himself the chief of sinners. There was a music major visiting Beethoven's house and seeing his piano, was tempted to sneak under the wire there to go play it. And as the guard and the director got a little farther ahead, he snuck under there and he started playing Beethoven's piano. Well, of course, the director came back really quickly and he apologized. I'm sorry, I just couldn't resist. I had to play it. He says, I'm a music major. The director said, you know, 2 weeks ago, the great Paderewski was here and we asked him if he would like to play Beethoven's piano. And he refused, saying, I could never sit at the same piano that Beethoven sat at. You know, how often we think more highly of ourselves than we ought to think. And when we really have a true understanding of what the Lord is doing within us, we're like children. We're thankful that he uses us. I don't ever want to become so important that I forget. It's like, this is a joy to serve the Lord. It's exciting to be used of him. I want to keep that simplicity there. I mean, we are all kids just learning what it means to follow him. And that's what I believe Jesus is saying here. He who is least among you will be great. Now, John answered, and of course this next story here illustrates that there was also the problem of having an improper view of others. And John answered and said, Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him because he does not follow with us. But Jesus said to him, Do not forbid him, for he who is not against us is on our side. Now this to me is quite interesting because, of course, the disciples were commissioned to have that power to cast out demons, and they saw this other guy doing it, and they wondered, well, you know, he's not with us. And so they decided to try to forbid him. And John perhaps is maybe even trying to ignore the first issue the Lord is bringing up about becoming humble, but, or maybe he's honest and he just doesn't know, did he do the right thing? And he's asking. We forbade him because he doesn't follow with us. So Jesus rebukes him and says, no, hey, don't forbid him. See, those laboring alongside us, we've got to remember, we're not in competition. We're not in competition here at Calvary with other churches in the area. That's ridiculous. We're all on the same team. If every church in this area were filled to capacity and overflowing, we would still just be scratching the surface of the needs in this area. You know, we've got to not look at others with a suspicious look because they're not with us, or ever think, you know, well, I go to Calvary and, you know, if you don't go there, well, you're not really with a good church. How foolish to think that. We must realize that God has his people in many different places. And you know, there's some great churches from Baptist to Pentecostal and everything in between throughout this area. Now, this doesn't validate all other churches because there are some funky ones out there. There are some weird ones. I mean, I hear some stories that I can't believe of the ways that, you know, things that are being taught and the practices that are being, you know, done in certain places, and I go, oh, Lord, help. That's certainly not the model Jesus set. But at the same time, we ought not to think, you know, we're it. It's kind of a misguided loyalty, which makes us look suspicious at others, and, ooh, you know, they're not with us. Jesus rebukes that. Don't forbid him. Now, apparently, you know, this man, what kind of a man was he casting out demons? Well, No, he probably wasn't doing it presumptuously because the Lord had commissioned his disciples and he was there and he thought, well, hey, I'm going to go. I'm going to trust the Lord. You know, there was a guy who did that presumptuously, or there was a group of men who tried to presume upon that power. They weren't called of God. In Acts chapter 19, it's one of the funniest stories where, you know, as Paul was casting out demons and healing people, these seven sons of this Jewish priest, named Siva thought, hey, we can do that. So they came up to a demonized man and they said, we adjure you by Jesus, whom Paul preaches, to come out of him. Well, the demon in the man said, Jesus we know, Paul we know, who are you? And the man, this is so funny, in Acts 19, you got to read it, the man in whom the demons were in jumped on these seven guys, beat them up, wounded them, and sent them up running naked. It was like a brawl. You know, the idea is you don't presume to do something unless the Lord calls you. So apparently this guy had a call, so he wasn't doing it presumptuously. And also, his heart was there in the right place. It must have been, because Jesus later rebuked those. He said, you know, many say, Lord, Lord, did we not cast out demons in your name? Did we not heal in your name? And the Lord will say, depart from me, I never knew you. There was really no relationship. Now, Paul said, there are some who preach from envy and strife. But he says, in all ways, I rejoice that the name of Christ is being mentioned. Because you know where the name of Christ is mentioned, you can be surprised. Don't be surprised how the Lord can use it, even if it's in a negative way. Sometimes I see coverage on the TV of some weird thing, and Christians are being brought into this, and the name of Christ is being maligned. And yet, even that, sometimes you can be surprised how God can use even a ridicule of Christianity. I know He used it in my life, reading a French philosopher, Voltaire, who was mocking Christianity, and his book was one of the reasons I came to the Lord. So God can use it. Now, Jesus said, don't forbid him. Now, in another place, Jesus said almost the opposite. Well, he said, he who is not with me is against me. He who does not gather with me scatters. But in each context, it fits. In this context, this man was not against Jesus. He just wasn't with the disciples in the particular way. So don't forbid him. And another context is, if you're not for Jesus, then you are against him. If you're not actively pursuing him, then you're going away from him. There is no neutral ground, and we must understand that. So the first thing here I see about improper view of others is don't forbid others. Don't look at yourself as the only one that's there. Now the second part of the improper view of others comes in verse 51. It came to pass when the time had come for him to be received up, that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. Now is the time where his ministry is going to take on a new focus. He's heading toward Jerusalem. He's going to go down there and he's not going to come back. It's going to be the final time he's there, and the ministry is going to be coming to a close as he lifts his life up on the cross. So he's steadfastly going. Well, they sent messengers before his face. As they're traveling from Galilee, they have to go through Samaria down into Judea or Jerusalem. And he sent messengers to go into a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him, you know, to find some hospitality. You know, they have quite an entourage with them, and they're going to need housing and a place to eat. But when they did not receive him because his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem, that's the problem. They didn't receive him because he was going to Jerusalem. Well, really, it's quite interesting, this whole story of the Samaritans. Because what happens with them is that in 2 Kings chapter 17, we realize when the Assyrians came in and they took all the peoples from the northern countries away, they planted other people in there. And so there was kind of a mixed breed of people, some who didn't know the Lord. And they tried to worship the Lord, but they changed a lot of things and they made it convenient to them. And they didn't go down to Jerusalem. They figured they could worship on Mount Gerizim. And they started all new traditions. So there was a lot of false things going on. And then when the captive people from Babylon came back and wanted to rebuild the temple under Ezra, they refused to let the Samaritans join in. So there was some bad blood there. Even Josephus, the historian, mentions that if you were traveling on the way from Galilee to Jerusalem and you went through Samaria, you had to be careful, because if you were going to Jerusalem and they knew it, some of them might, you know, lay you up by the side of the road and kill you or rob you or abuse you. There was a lot of bad blood. And yet, here now they come in, and Jesus is not received. And when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, just as Elijah did? In their minds, hey, you've rejected Jesus, so hey, let's call fire down. Now that story of Elijah is quite an interesting story too. As he was sitting there, and this king wanted to find him, who hated him, because he was a prophet of God. So he sent 50 soldiers and a commander to go get him. Well, the commander came up and says, "Man of God, come down. We're going to take you to the king." And Elijah said, "Hey, if I am a man of God, let fire come down out of heaven and consume you." They were consumed. Just like that, gone. Well, the king sent another group of 50 with a commander. The commander says, "Man of God, come down. We need to take you to the king." And Elijah said, "If I am a man of God, let fire come down out of heaven and consume you." Consumed. Well, the king sent another group of 50 with a commander. Now, this guy got wised up a little bit. He came up to Elijah and said, "Oh, Elijah, please, have mercy on me and these men here. You know, let our lives be precious in your sight. And would you please, 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 please come down to the king?" And Elijah went with him. Now, that was an example. You know, Elijah's like a type of the law, uncompromising. You get in God's face and you're consumed. But then the next prophet is quite interesting. Just to contrast that, Elisha, Elijah's servant, when Elijah was taken up, Elisha then took over the ministry. He was like a picture of grace, amazing grace. Because then the Syrian captain tried to capture him with a group of his army men. The army of the Lord stood around the camp of the Syrians. And then what happened is he caused blindness to come to all the men. Now, Elisha said, "Hey, let me lead you the one you want." And he led them right into the king's presence of Israel so that they could capture all those Syrians. So the king of Israel says, "You want me to kill him now?" And Elisha says, "By no means. Sit him down, give him a good meal, and then send him home." So we did that. Sent those guys home. They're blowing their mind. "They're not killing us. They're feeding us food. I wonder if this is poison." "No, it's good. This is good. This is great." And they're on their way home and they're shaking their heads like, "What happened?" Because God is merciful, and he wanted to show that. But I think that when you look at the spirit that James and John had, it's not an unusual thing for us to feel that way when we're trying to reach someone for the Lord. We have their best interest in mind, and they malign our motives, and they ridicule us, or they mock us, and they reject us, and they falsely accuse you. It's hard. You know, sometimes I've felt this. "Lord, bring fire down out of heaven. Let them have it. If they don't want to hear you, then fine. Let them burn. Let them toast." I mean, I've felt that. You've felt that sometimes when you've been persecuted. At the same time, that's not the right spirit. We have to learn that God is merciful. In fact, though the Samaritans rejected Jesus like this, because he was going to Jerusalem, later on, in Acts chapter 9, there's a revival in Samaria where all these people, thousands of people, come to the Lord. So God is merciful. Well, he rebuked the disciples. He said, "You do not know what manner of spirit you are of, for the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." So they went on to another village. They didn't make it an issue. And you know, I think there's an instructive instruction here for us. We are commissioned to go and tell people the gospel. But realize this, we're commissioned to tell them. But after we tell them and they don't want to hear it, you don't keep pushing it. You don't keep feeling it's your duty to keep cramming it down someone's throat. In fact, Paul the Apostle, who was the most bold witness you could find, I mean, he was like an in-your-face, "I'm going to tell you about the Lord" kind of guy. Yet even he said, "I will go to all who are willing to listen." Now, if you find someone who's not willing to listen, what do you do? Hey, you turn them over to the Lord. Let the Lord deal with them. It might not be their time. Just like the Samaritans, you know, hey, don't have an attitude toward them or try to force issue. In due time, the Lord will deal with them. But you don't have to force the issue. You know, you don't have to be pushy. You don't have to be obnoxious. You know, especially around your family. You know, once you've told them where you stand, you don't have to keep preaching to them. Let your light shine. Let your life be the message. And you know what? As you do, that will open up more doors to share your faith. But you go to those who are willing. You go to those who are willing. You know, for some reason, I just can't picture Jesus. When the rich young ruler came to Jesus and then went away sad because he didn't want to follow the Lord because of what it would cost him, you don't see Jesus chasing him down the road, saying, "Oh, come on, please, you know, come back. We'll work something out. You know, don't leave." He let him go. So it's the most scary thing in the world, though. You just let someone go and you pray and hope and trust that God will find another way to get them. Now in verse 57, we come to the improper view of the call of God. There are three would-be followers of Jesus here who all are short-circuited with something. In fact, you know, each of these guys fail in some aspect, and it becomes a good lesson for us. They fail in some aspect to be the disciple of Jesus because of some issue or some condition that they put before they can follow the Lord. Notice what happens. The first guy, it happened as he journeyed on the road that someone said to him, "Lord, I will follow you wherever you go." Well, that sounds pretty good. And in fact, it was indeed, I'm sure, his heart. He probably saw the glory of what God was doing through Jesus. He saw the miracles and the crowds, the excitement, and he wanted to be a part of it. And that was a good motive. Except one thing. He fails, really, to count the cost. To have such exuberance, anyone would want to hear that. As a pastor, I'd love to hear people say, "I'll do whatever the Lord wants me to do." I love to hear that. But I also know that it's important for you to count the cost. Jesus, in a sense, it sounds like he's discouraging the guy. He said to him, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." It's kind of like, hey, guy, you know, I don't know if you realize what it's going to cost you. I don't know if you realize what you're getting yourself into, but I want you to know that you're following me for the glory and everything's going to be great, but understand I'm going through the cross before the glory. The cross comes before the glory. And he wanted him to know that. Interestingly enough, you know, Jesus did have nowhere to lay his head. Judah had rejected him. Galilee had cast him out. Gadara, remember when he went over on the other side of the Sea of Galilee? The man that was possessed that he healed, the people of Gadara begged him to leave. "We can't handle you. You're too radical for us." Samaria refused lodging for him. The earth would not have him, and even later on the cross, heaven will forsake him as he becomes that sin offering for us. He was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. He was a man rejected by this world, yet being the chief cornerstone, yet rejected of men. Jesus wants this guy to count the cost, and this man failed to count the cost. His faith was shallow. It was emotional. And there are a great many people that have this emotional response at one moment, "Yes, Lord, whatever you want." But when it comes down to really making the sacrifice, to be faithful in the areas of giving and regularly attending and getting, you know, reaching out to others for their faith, they fail in those areas. They're not truly being a disciple. And Jesus wanted this man to count the cost first. Now, we don't know whether he followed up on that or not. Doesn't say, because we go to the next man. Then Jesus, he said to another, "Follow me." But he said, "Lord, let me first go and bury my father." Jesus said to him, "Let the dead bury their own dead, but you go and preach the kingdom of God." Now this sounds pretty brash. It's like, you know, this poor guy's got his father just died. Let him go to the funeral and then he'll come and follow you. That's what it appears like when you read this, but that's not really what's happening. This was actually an expression in the East, to bury my father, that meant, let me first wait till my father dies. I'll get the inheritance, I'll finish up all that family, accountability, and I'll get my, inheritance, then I can go and follow you. That's what this man is actually saying. Now this man counted the cost. He had a better, truer picture of what it was going to mean to follow Jesus. Hey, if he doesn't have a place to stay, we're going to need money, and you know, I need to wait for my father to die, and then I'll get my inheritance, and then, you know, we can go, and that'll be great. I'll wait for my retirement, and then I'll get settled in. I'll serve the Lord when I retire. Well, Jesus said, let the dead bury their own dead. How many people have been short-circuited from truly following the Lord because though they count the cost, they count the cost without having all the facts? You see, he did not take into account who Jesus was, how great he is. His fears were in control. You know, the Lord may ask you to do something you don't want to do. What will you do? We think we know what's best so often, but we don't. You know, two of the biggest killers are auto accidents and heart disease. Those are the two things that kill more people than anything else. Now, Both of those things are the things we control. Our attitude on the road and our appetite. And yet, those things that we're in control of, look, we end up killing ourselves. Jesus knows us much better. You know, we've got to be careful of how we let things become more important. This man did not rightly count the cost. He counted it, but he didn't take in all the facts. He bought into the ownership lie that what counts is having some type of status and income and you know, I've got to have this. It is an illusion, folks. Be careful of this. When you say, well, I own a house and I own a car and I own, you know, this, a boat, what are you saying? Well, you've got a paper that proves you own it. Well, what is ownership? What is it? It's an illusion. It doesn't mean anything. First word that a child learns is mine. It seems like we have a hard time getting past that first word. Mine is so important to us. I own. We sometimes judge others by what they own, and we look at ourselves on the basis of our ownership. What is ownership? You have a heart attack and they take you out feet first on a stretcher. Someone asks, who's that? Well, that's the owner. Really? In the back of the funeral, you hear someone say, you know, how much did he leave behind? And someone else says, all of it, I believe. You know, it's been said, you can't take it with you, and it's true. But you know, there's another saying I like. You can send it on ahead. You can. You can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. You can lay up treasures in heaven. And this is what this man is not taking into account. He's not taking into account the riches, the glory in heaven. Yes, the cross is there, and he's got a good view of that, and he's trying to hedge his bet with that. He's trying to make it a little more comfortable. But you know, we're pilgrims. We're just passing through. We have to be careful of what we let control us. You know, there's this whole picture of, you know, ownership. You know, we make a big mistake when we consider what Jesus has done for us. The Bible says he purchased us with his own blood. We've been bought with a price. Therefore, we're called to glorify God. He's our Lord and Master. If you asked him as Lord in your life, what does that mean? Jesus said, why do you call me Lord, Lord, when you don't do the things that I say? That implies you've relinquished your life to him. Yielded it willingly, but you've yielded it. Now, were you going to take it back? If you do, you've stolen your life back from the Lord. You see, it's not yours to take. If I went down to Oasis Ford and I snuck in at night and I stole the vehicle, and a year later the police caught up to me, and they says, hey, what are you doing with this vehicle? And I says, well, officer, you know, I mean, I know I took it, but look how nice I've kept it. I mean, this is clean. Is this clean or what? I mean, I wax it and I wash it. I keep it all nice and I change the oil every 3,000 miles. I keep the engine in good condition. And not only that, officer, I do some good things with this. I take food through Broken Loaves Ministry and I take it to people and I bring people to the church. And, you know, I'm doing a lot of good things with this car. Now, what would the man say to me? It's not yours. So what? Doesn't matter what you do with it. It's not yours to do anything with it. Now, there are a great many people who are doing good things with their life and trying to do honorable things and live a good moral life, taking good care of their bodies and health. Problem is, they've stolen it from God. God created you. He has ownership over you. He redeemed you. He bought you with a price. He has ownership over you. And discipleship is coming to that realization that really my life is the Lord's. And this man says, let me go first and bury my father, is not taking into account that his life isn't his to take. Let me first go. I've got a plan. I've got an agenda. So the first guy doesn't count the cost. The second guy counts the cost, but wrongly. And the third guy, quite interestingly enough, I call this the guy that tries to lower the cost. Notice what he says. He said to another, Lord, I will follow you, but let me first go and bid farewell to those who are at my house. You know, this man said, yes, I'll go, but I want to just say goodbye. And, you know, I've got my thing that I've got to do, but I want to make it a little easier to make this transition. Now again, we would look at this in the natural and think, what's wrong with that? Even Elisha did that to Elijah. When Elijah called him, he says, well, let me go and bid farewell to my family. And Elijah says, what have I to do with you? Go. So he went, said goodbye, made a sacrifice, and then came back and served Elijah. So there's nothing wrong in that in itself. But you see, there's something happening with this man that, again, it's like, you know, I'm going to go, but there's a few things I want to take care of. I want to say goodbye and this and that. In a way, he's trying to make it a little bit easier, a little more palatable. Problem is, you can't revolve serving the Lord around your own personal life. It has to be the other way around. Your personal life should be revolved around serving the Lord. As you go out in the field and you do your work and you come back as a servant does, you know, and you don't say, okay, now, Lord, you do for me. Rather, you keep serving. You keep faithful. Your life is not your own. It's amazing how we, even in the ministry here, can start catering to our carnal nature. Even the word volunteer, quite honestly, I don't like that word volunteer because it smacks too much of a, you know, well, you know, I've got my life, but I'll volunteer a little time for the church. That is an erroneous idea. You know, we're looking for people who are servants. We're looking for people who really see themselves as, I'm called by God to do this. I want to do it. I want to be faithful and be committed. But you know, too few people are committed. They're afraid of that C word. And yet ask yourself, is your life your own? I mean, this is true discipleship. I know this might be a big chunk of meat for some of you to swallow. But it's true. You see, some say, well, I'll serve as long as I can be off. In our nursery, you know, we have you on and off so because we don't want you to get burnt out. But we're not trying to make it so easy that there's no sacrifice involved. Hey, there is a sacrifice when you desire to serve the Lord. You're putting aside certain things you'd want to do to serve Him and to honor Him. And we can't come at it and approach it like, well, I'll sign up as long as you don't expect me to be there all the time. As long as I can have, you know, 2 weeks off when I want it, and I can do this and I can do that. Let me go say goodbye to my family. You know what I'm saying? That's the whole spirit here that's being said. It's a small wonder that laborers are so few. It's no small wonder, rather. I would go on the mission field if it were not for blank. You fill in the blank. What is it that keeps you from going in the mission field? What is it that keeps you from serving the Lord? See, I really believe that's where your true joy will come in. As we gain a better understanding of who Jesus is, we will not only count the cost, we'll count it rightly, and we'll be willing to say, yes, Lord, here am I. But I think we need to see more clearly His glory, to detach all from us that hinders us and entangles us. Lay aside every weight that entangles you, the Scriptures say. Paul wrote to the Corinthians and said, do you not know that all those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. You know, they do it for a perishable crown, but we an imperishable crown. I think of the hours and the agony and the time I spent in dieting and making weight for wrestling and working out and going out there and laboring to win. And, you know, I come back after winning a tournament and wrestling a whole bunch of guys and I get this little tiny medal and I've got it in my office, and I'm looking, I can't believe the hours of pain I had to pay for this stinking little piece of bronze. You know, what is it? What do we do for perishable crowns? It's amazing. And yet, for that which is imperishable, what are we unwilling for? Because we're not walking by faith, you see. We're walking by sight. We need to open our eyes to see by faith, to see those treasures in heaven, to go forward, to fight not as one who beats the air. Paul says, I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest having preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. I've got to watch over those things. Hey, drop any anchor that's holding you back. For me, an anchor in the beginning was my scholarship at the university. It was an anchor to me. I knew it wasn't that the Lord had in mind, and for 2 years I strived with the Lord on that. And finally, you know, after my second year, I went out into the ministry and I sought the Lord to be trained in ministry. What a joy that was. But my family thought I was nuts. I had a full scholarship. Then I remember being in California and being in ministry and an associate pastor for 5 years. And yet there was something discontentment. There was a discontentment growing. I knew the Lord wanted me to go out and plant a church and do something else. And But it was that anchor of the house. We just got our house in California, and I liked the mountains and the beach and all these things. It was, you know, it's just everything was set. I could have been there for the next 15 years, but just something was gnawing at me to go for it. So we sold the house, and we moved out here to New Jersey. And I'll tell you, the joy in doing this. I mean, I can't believe, I mean, when I think back on that decision, it's like, I almost didn't come, but, oh, Lord, thank you. Thank you that you confirmed this. I feel the Lord has a great doorway of joy for many of you. But you got to be willing to trust Him. Be willing to be His disciple. Have a proper view of yourself as a child before the Lord. Have a proper view of others. You're not the only one serving. There are others too. Don't compare yourself with others. But have a proper view of the call of God, what it means. Here am I, Lord. Send me.